to be discussing Pope Francis, the Gospel, and Catholic social teaching. And I thank you for your interest in coming. Anytime you're speaking at the same time Scott Hahn is speaking and anybody shows up, it's already a success. This is a very large topic that necessarily we're going to have to narrow. But before we constrict the scope, I'd like to situate what we'll discuss within the larger context of Pope Francis's papacy and within the Church's social doctrine so that we'll know where the parts we have the time to tackle fit into the whole. First thing to take in terms of overview is, how does Pope Francis envision his papacy? I think we can clearly see it in two fonts. One is the speech he gave to his brother cardinal 6 days before they elected him. It was within what's called the General Congregation, the closed-door meetings the cardinals of the world have to discuss the major issues facing the Church, begin to think about the qualities they believe they need in the next pope, and then begin to scan the room to try to spot someone who might be having those qualities that they think are essential. On March 7th, 2013, Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio spoke very briefly about what he saw the chief corruption of the Church is, the chief area where the Church needed to be reformed, and what job criteria were most necessary for the next Bishop of Rome. He said that the chief sickness the Church faced was a theological narcissism, an ecclesial introversion, a self-referentialism in which the Church lives within herself, by herself, and for herself. And therefore, he said, what was most needed was a pope who, from prayer, basically the contemplation and adoration of Jesus Christ, helps the Church to go to the existential peripheries, who helps her to be a fruitful mother who gains life from the sweet and comforting task of evangelizing. The Church is always in need of going from, as we say in the United States, maintenance to mission, from caring for those who are already coming to finding the lost, to finding those who have wandered, those who have been left on the margins before, beyond people's interest, beyond people's concern. And his brother cardinals evidently agreed with him about what the Church most needed and thought that he was the most capable among them to lead that reform. The second source where we see how Pope Francis envisions his papacy is in his programmatic apostolic exhortation, The Joy of the Gospel, published 8 months into his papacy, in which he tried to describe the missionary metamorphosis, the evangelical rebuilding of the Church that he had been elected to effectuate. "I dream of a missionary impulse," he wrote, "capable of transforming everything, so that the Church's customs, ways of doing things, times and schedule, languages and structures can all be suitably channeled for the evangelization of today's world rather than for self-preservation. Everything the Church is and does, every institution in the Church, every member of the mystical body of the Church, every school, parish, every hospital, food pantry, every man, woman, boy, and girl, he wants to help find their root in contemplation and adoration of Christ so that they might go out united with Mother Church to find, heal, and nourish all the children entrusted to her." For Pope Francis, who always fundamentally teaches the faith by showing the faith, whose witness is more compelling than his words, this missionary metamorphosis will be evident in the way that the Church lives out her social teaching. So we'll have a chance to examine in greater depth later. Pope Francis wrote in The Joy of the Gospel, "To evangelize is to make the kingdom of God present in the world. The kerygma, that fancy word that St. Paul uses a lot to symbolize the proclamation of Jesus, who loved us so much that he entered our world, took on our nature, died for us, and rose from the dead to make eternal life possible, who continues to walk with us every day to transform our life from within. That kerygma," he said, "has a clear social content. At the very heart of the gospel is life in community and engagement with others. The content of the first proclamation, that Jesus is alive and with us and he saved us, the content of that first proclamation has an immediate moral implication centered on charity. from the heart of the gospel, we see the profound connection between evangelization and human advancement, which must necessarily find expression and develop in every work of evangelization. Accepting the first proclamation, which invites us to receive God's love and to love Him in return with the very love with which is His gift, brings forth in our lives and actions a primary and fundamental response to desire, seek, and protect the good of others. In other words, we haven't been evangelized until we take the church's social doctrine seriously and begin to live it. Therefore, Pope Francis doesn't want us merely to study and know the church's social teaching, but he wants us with him to strive to live it to the full. He recognized that the church's social teaching, lived, is an indispensable part of the reshaping, the reform of the church, and one of the immediate consequences of men and women, boys and girls, who have been truly evangelized, that they will seek to enflesh the love of the Lord by crossing the road to help all those in need. And that's where the church's social teaching fits into the whole papal program. So first thing I want to say in overview, this is not an add-on to Pope Francis's true thrust, but this is a necessary development. Second thing I want to ponder in introduction is where what we'll cover today in depth fits into the overall picture of the church's social teaching. In the 2004 Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Catholic Church, published by St. John Paul II through the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, there were seven domains of church social teaching listed, each of which has been getting attention from Pope Francis. We're only really going to focus on one of them, but I want to do at least a small survey of how he's focusing on the other areas. First domain mentioned was the domain of marriage and family. If we're going to be taking the church's social teaching seriously, evangelizers are going to be working here in the field of marriage and family. This has been one of his chief concerns, which he made the first priority of the restructured Synod of Bishops. He had said in one of his many papal interviews that as soon as he had become pope and begun to think about the Synod for Bishops, he wanted the first focus of the church throughout the world to be on strengthening the family, which he recognizes is in crisis. For the last several months, he's been doing a catechesis on the importance of marriage in the family, of moms, of dads, of children, of caring for the elderly, of making sure that we're passing on everything that a child needs to receive from the hospital or the home. He's made the family the goal of this extraordinary and ordinary synod which is coming on up. And he wrote in his Evangelii Gaudium that the family is in crisis, and that's why it needs the urgent attention of all Catholics. He said, "The family is experiencing a profound moral and cultural crisis, as are all communities and social bonds. In the case of the family, the weakening of these bonds is particularly serious, because the family is the fundamental cell of society, where we learn to live with others despite our differences and to belong to one another. It's a place where parents pass on the faith to their children. Marriage now tends to be viewed as a form of mere emotional satisfaction that can be constructed in any way or modified at will. But the indispensable contribution of marriage to society transcends the feelings and momentary needs of the couple." So that's one of the domains of Catholic social teaching that has been getting a lot of his attention. Second domain is human work, the dignity of work, the right to work, the rights of workers working in solidarity. From before the papacy and during it, he's focused a lot on unemployment and how work is an absolutely crucial aspect of human dignity. He gave a book-length interview back in 2010 called El Jesuita in Spanish, translated into English as Conversations with Jorge Mario Bergoglio. And when they asked a question, the two interviewers, about the unemployed, he said that often the unemployed feel like they don't really exist. No matter how much help they might get from their family or friends, they want to work. They want to earn their daily bread from the sweat of their brow. The thing is, at the end of the day, work anoints a person with dignity. Dignity comes from work. We eat what we earn. We support our families with what we earn. Doesn't matter if it's a lot or a little. If it's more, all the better. We can own a fortune, but if we don't work, our dignity plummets. A typical example is that of the immigrant who arrives with nothing, but who struggles, works hard, and achieves the American dream. But they have to be careful, because their children or grandchildren might become spoiled if they're not instilled with a good work ethic. Work opens the door to reality, and in itself constitutes a clear mandate from God. God tells us to be masters of the work, masters of the earth, to work, to subdue it. What happens is that the unemployed, in their hours of solitude, begin to feel miserable because they're not earning their living. That's why it's so important that governments of all countries cultivate a culture of work, not of charity. They have to cultivate sources of work because, and I never tire to repeat this, work confers dignity. And he brought these ideas with him to the papacy. First time he celebrated on May 1st, the feast of St. Joseph the Worker, he reiterated these themes. He said, we do not get dignity from power or from money or from culture. We get it from work. Work is fundamental to the human person's dignity. To use an image, work anoints with dignity because it fills us with dignity, makes us similar to God who has worked and still works and who always acts. So the Church's social teaching involves this gospel of human work, which transforms us as workers. The intransitive impact of work is even greater than whatever we make in the transitive aspect of work. Because, as St. Gregory of Nyssa used to say in the early church, we become our parents through our work, through the way precisely we do our work, whether it's done with virtue or whether it's done shoddily. Third locus of church social teaching is the political community, which summarizes political authority, a democratic system, civil society, etc. And in this sphere, Pope Francis has also been putting into practice the Church's social teaching. He's had various diplomatic conversations with heads of state, both in the Vatican and his foreign trips. But most of his interventions, up until this point at least, have focused on thundering against corruption and making sure those in political office use that office for the common good rather than for their own aggrandizement. Earlier this year in the Philippines, Pope Francis focused on the necessity of integrity in leaders as one of society's most important resources to move forward. He said the example of solidarity in the work of rebuilding teaches us an important lesson. Like a family, every society draws its deepest resources in order to face new challenges. Today, the Philippines faces the challenge of building on solid foundations of a modern society and to confront new and complex political and ethical questions. As many voices in your nation have pointed out, it is now more than ever necessary that political leaders be outstanding for honesty, integrity, and commitment to the common good. Thus, will they be able to marshal the moral resources needed to face today's demands, to pass on to coming generation, a society of authentic justice, solidarity, and peace. He knows that governments will never fulfill their goal if they're dominated by those who are trying to use it for their own personal and exclusive advancement. It's part of church social teaching. Fourth is the international community. Fundamental rules organizing the interaction between states, organization, cooperation for development, and so forth. When he visited the European Union last November, he pondered the role of government in fostering the transcendent dignity of the human person. He pondered the importance of the rule of law against tyranny, which we see constantly raise its ugly head, on the right of religious freedom, on how to keep democracy alive against what he called political nominalism, just using the right terms but not delivering the goods, as well as against the many globalizing tendencies to dilute reality, namely dictatorships of relativism, brands of ahistorical fundamentalism, ethical systems lacking kindness, and intellectual discourse bereft of wisdom. He's trying again, as part of church social teaching, to help the leaders of nations to raise themselves up to these higher levels of thought and leadership. The fifth is peace. Pope Francis has gotten involved as a peacemaker, the United States and Cuba, with Israel and Palestine. He's given a peace message to the diplomatic corps each year. It's interesting to focus on what his themes are as the foundations for peace, again, flowing straight from Catholic social doctrine. 2014, he spoke about the importance of genuine fraternity in a culture of solidarity in a globalized world that makes us neighbors, but often not brothers. He stressed that fraternity is the foundation and pathway of peace and interpreted the social magisterium within this lens. Try to bring about those greater bonds between people. We see that, for example, in a lot of the immigration disputes. If we were looking at immigrants, legal or illegal, as brothers or sisters, our attitudes would often change. Because most of us wouldn't say to our blood brother or sister, if they weren't carrying the right color card, get out of my country. We wouldn't do it that way. But to overcome the ways that we label people and see others as siblings is something that he says is necessary for world peace. Because at the same time, oftentimes we're not going to fight to the end against the son or the daughter of the mother or father that we love. In 2015, he built on this message of fraternity by focusing on the negation of fraternity in the many forms of modern slavery that work against peace. Something that couldn't happen if we were really looking with the lens of spiritual siblings. He mentioned among these new forms of slaves, migrants who in their dramatic odyssey experience hunger, are deprived of freedom, robbed of their possessions, or undergo physical or sexual abuse. Others who, because of poverty, become part of a system of slave labor, even when young. Of women forced into prostitution, many of whom are minors, as well as male and female sex slaves. Of all those persons, minors and adults alike, who are made objects of trafficking for the sale of their organs, or as recruitment as soldiers, for begging, for illegal activities such as the production and sale of drugs, for disguised forms of cross-border adoption. He also mentioned all those kidnapped and held captive by terrorist groups, subjected to their purposes as combatants, or above all, in the case of young girls and women, to be used as sex slaves. He's really trying to confront the raw materials that lead to the disintegration of the foundations necessary for peace. The sixth is the environment, which is going with tomorrow's announcement of or publication of Laudato Si, is new encyclical, going to take up a very prominent role within the church and outside in terms of the conversation. But it's not new for Pope Francis. He's been speaking about environmental concerns from his inaugural homily, in which he focused on how we're all called to be protectors like St. Joseph and specified that we have the gift to protect the gift of creation God has given us. He said on March 19, 2013, "It means protecting all creation, the beauty of the created world, as the book of Genesis tells us and as St. Francis of Assisi showed us. It means respecting each of God's creatures and respecting the environment in which we live. In this end, everything has been entrusted to our protection, and all of us are responsible for it. Therefore, be protectors of God's gifts." And I'd like to ask all of those who have positions of responsibility in economic, political, and social life, and all men and women of goodwill, let us be protectors of creation, protectors of God's plan inscribed in nature, protectors of one another and of the environment. This is what we're going to see when the document comes out tomorrow. Pope Francis, in Laudato Si, is making an appeal to every single person to care for the gift of creation and not to look at it merely as a resource to be used. He said in an interview that the environment is not something that we receive from our ancestors. It's a loan we've received from future generations and that we need to keep whole and give them back with gratitude and interest. In the encyclical, he has a very rich section in the Gospel of Creation and another on an ecological spirituality based on reverence for God and the gift of creation that he's called us to subdue, steward, increase, and multiply. Pope Francis unites environmental ecology with human and social ecology and connects the link we see in the book of Genesis between God, each other, and the gift of creation. The care for the environment is part of the church's social doctrine. And the last of those seven domains is economic life, the morality of the economy, private initiative, business initiative, etc. This is where we're going to spend the majority of our time today, because it is part of his burgeoning papal corpus that's most controversial here in the United States and would probably most repay our study. Main point I'd want to stress before we go on, though, is that Pope Francis is focused on all of these various domains of Catholic social teaching as part of his missionary reform of the Church. If someone is truly evangelized, to the extent that one is moved to share the gospel fully with others, it will impact the way he or she approaches one's own marriage and family, as well as marriage and family in general, one's approach to one's own work and that of others, one's involvement in politics and concern for others' good at a local, state, national, and international level, one's becoming not just a peace wisher or a peace prayer, but a peacemaker, one who cares for the gift of creation God has given as a precious inheritance to pass on with love to others, as well as how one makes economic choices and sets up economic situations that express truly the values that come from our faith. Pope Francis has been trying to lead a missionary reform that embraces and transforms everything, including all of these pillars of Catholic social teaching. But now I'd like to turn to the main body of the talk, which is on Pope Francis, the gospel, and economics within the missionary transformation of the Church. Most controversial part of Evangelii Gaudium, his apostolic exhortation that set out the program for his papacy, was its section on economics. It's what captured all of the headlines when the exhortation appeared. Pope Francis denounces market-based capitalism, was one representative above the full commentary. Many of the articles, rather than focusing on all the Holy Father had said about evangelization, gave most or all of their copy to what he said about free markets and economics. They regularly repeated some eye-raising statements, especially for many of us here in the States, like the socioeconomic system is unjust at its root, the economy of exclusion and inequality kills, there's a need to reject the absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation. Inequality is the root of all social ills. We can no longer trust in the unseen forces, an invisible hand of the market. And some people continue to defend trickle-down theories that assume that economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. Even though elsewhere in the document Pope Francis praised business as a noble vocation, many businessmen on our shores took what Pope Francis was saying as a direct attack. Cardinal Dolan of New York said that some major donors to the capital campaign to renovate St. Patrick's Basilica expressed serious concerns and some hesitancy to follow through on all their efforts for the church. Some wondered how Pope Francis' words meshed with his dependence on international business leaders and business consultants to revamp and lead the Vatican Bank, to reorganize Vatican communications, to examine the flowchart of Vatican dicasteries, and more. Some theologians wondered how some statements were consistent with St. John Paul II's Centesimus Annus, that the free market appears to be the most efficient instrument for utilizing resources and effectively responding to solvent needs at the level of individual nations and international relations, and that the business or market or free economy, understood as an economic system that recognized the fundamental and positive role of business, the market, private property, and the resulting responsibility for the means of production, as well as free human creativity in the economic sector, is certainly the model that ought to be proposed to the countries of the Third World that are searching for the path to true economic and civil progress. What Pope Francis was not trying to do, he said in his exhortation, was to propose an economic model, because that's not the Church's ambition, mission, or competence, he said. Rather, his exhortation wasn't a social document, but he said that pastors have a right to offer opinions and proposals and draw practical conclusions, lest the great social principles of the Church's social teaching remain mere generalities that don't challenge anyone. Scholars can justly question whether his critique applies more to the Gilded Age than the present one, when especially in the United States there are very few, except anarcho-capitalists, who think that supply-side economics alone will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness, whether there are those who support the unregulated absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation, whether there's a crude and naive trust in the unforeseen forces and invisible hand of the market, or in CEOs or in major economic actors, and whether businessmen treat as sacred the inner workings of the economic system. There have been several scholarly articles that have made cases that Pope Francis really has in his crosshairs the crony capitalism that has destroyed the economy in Argentina since Peronism began in 1946, rather than the economic system that's led millions in China, India, Japan, Singapore, and other East Asian countries out of poverty. They doubt very much that it implies en masse to the real economic setup here. But these considerations, as important as they are missing the main point that I think Pope Francis was trying to get to in his exhortation and in many of his other statements during his papacy up until now. Even if he had in mind the corrupt economic system in Argentina that led to massive unemployment and the creation of a situation in which so many people have been left behind and abandoned in poverty, as a few have gotten much richer, corrupt politicians very prominent among them, the main lines of his moral critique apply to all situations, and whether economic setups rule or serve. So what I'd like to do is to focus on seven aspects of his particular take on the Church's social teaching with regard to the economy necessary to contextualize all of his comments. The first is a poor church for the poor. 3 days after the white smoke emanated from the roof of the Sistine Chapel, Pope Francis met with journalists present in Rome. I was fortunate to be there. I was doing the television commentary for Raymond Arroyo on EWTN. On that meeting with us, Pope Francis explained a little bit of what happened in the election and why he ended up choosing as his papal moniker the nickname of the Poverello of Assisi. He said, "Some people wanted to know why the Bishop of Rome wished to be called Francis. Some thought of Francis Xavier, Francis de Sales, also Francis of Assisi. I'll tell you the story. During the election, I was seated next to the Archbishop Emeritus of São Paulo and Prefect Emeritus of the Congregation for the Clergy, Cardinal Claudio Hummes, a good friend. When things were looking dangerous for me, he encouraged me. And when the vote reached 2/3, there was the usual applause because the Pope had been elected. And he gave me a hug and a kiss, and he said, 'Non dimentichi poveri.' And he banged on his head. 'Don't forget the poor, the poor, the poor.' Then right away, thinking of the poor, I thought of Francis of Assisi. That's how the name came into my heart, Francis of Assisi. For me, he's a man of poverty. How I would like a church which is poor and for the poor." It's very interesting as an aside. He had been asked in an interview, you know, they had said that he was second in the election that elected Pope Benedict back in 2005. And they asked, you know, if it had come to you, what name would you have chosen? And he said, John 24, after John the 23rd. And it seems, based on his saying here, that the first time the thought had crossed his mind about what name he would choose if he were elected was when Cardinal Hummes started his mockingbird pecking of his cranium. But nevertheless, that was the reason. Francis, poverty, wanting a poor church, a spiritually poor church, like that first beatitude, that is all about serving the poor in the Lord's name, continuing his mission, proclaiming the gospel to the poor. Concern for the poor was not a new thought for Cardinal Bergoglio, as Cardinal Hummes was reminding him. This was something that was essential to his whole life as a priest and as a bishop. To grasp him in his perspective, we have to understand a little of what he did in Argentina, in the sprawling slums around Buenos Aires called the Villas Miserias. 20 of these, some with as many as 250,000 people, in which there were only 6 priests in the entire Archdiocese of Buenos Aires that would risk setting foot in. Many of them were police-free zones. Many of them had not been evangelized at all. Because he struggled to get the priest to go there, he started to go there himself, visiting literally everybody, kicking soccer balls around, blessing babies, celebrating the sacraments. When John Allen, who many of you would know, one of the top Catholic reporters in the U.S., visited after his election, he wanted to test just how well people knew Cardinal Bergoglio. No matter whom he asked, had you ever met him, they were able to run into their home and actually get a photograph with him. It was across the board in these places, such that when he was elected, he was called El Papa de las Villas, the Pope of the Villas. these villas miserias because he was so identified with what their real needs were. As we analyze anything for Pope Francis, I think it's worthwhile to always keep the context of the villas, because that'll explain some of his initiatives when we recognize that he's not really focused first on people in our circumstances, people in those peripheries. Pope Francis has been calling all of us as Christians to become examples of the first beatitude, so we will show what poverty of spirit is and how it leads to the kingdom. In Evangelii Gaudium, he sketched out in depth where the section of poverty in the economy fits into his missionary transformation of the church as a whole. He writes that care for the poor is the fruit of the evangelization of individuals and societies. When we've really received the gospel, we care for the poor. But our faith has to have consequences in the way that we relate to others, especially the poor. It says every individual Christian in every community is called to be an instrument of God for the liberation and promotion of the poor, for enabling them to become fully a part of society. This demands that we be docile and attentive to the cry of the poor and come to their aid. Mentions how God was always concerned with the poor in the Mosaic Law, and how he never ceases to hear the poor man's cry. He echoed St. James's poignant question, how does God's love abide in one who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses help? He says, this isn't a mission reserved to a few. Jesus tells us all, you give them something to eat. And that means, he says, working to eliminate some of the structural causes of poverty, promoting the integral development of the poor, as well as small acts of daily solidarity and meeting the real needs that we encounter. It says what this means is we need a new mindset which thinks in terms of community as brothers and sisters and the priority of the life of all. He said this message is so clear and direct coming from the Lord, so simple and eloquent that no ecclesial interpretation has the right to relativize it. It describes Jesus' own poverty, how the Lamb of God couldn't be redeemed in the rite of presentation by a lamb because his family was so poor, so there were two turtle doves. How he was born in a borrowed cave. How he was buried in a borrowed grave. How he didn't have a place to lay his head. Where when the apostles were hungry, they didn't even have any food to have at the miracle of the multiplication of the loaves. We could go on and on and on. Christ came and he shared in our poverty, so that by that poverty he could make us rich. And he says very powerfully, for the church, the option for the poor is primarily a theological category. What does he mean when he says that? A theological category means a category that speaks of God and in which God speaks. Theou logos in the Greek, God's word. Right? It's a category that speaks of God and in which God speaks. And we need to approach God in this theological category. We see this in Christ's own option to be poor. This is why he says, I want a church that is poor and for the poor. Prior to the papacy, he had worked on a document with all the bishops of Central and Latin America called the Parecida in 2007. It's his greatest pre-papal accomplishment. But he said, when we're talking about the poor, he said, we need to become traveling companions of our poorest brothers and sisters, even as far as martyrdom. That we're willing to sort of give our life. And once we do, then all other forms of charity become easier. Pope Benedict had said in his beautiful exhortation on God is Love, that the church's charitable mission is equally as important as the proclamation of the gospel and the celebration of the sacraments. And because it was that important, we needed deacons so that it wouldn't get lost as the apostles were doing their ministry of the word and prayer. This is what he's trying to reawaken the entire church to take up, that we're going to be a worldwide diaconia. But in order to do that, gets to the second point of what he's been saying in context, we have to overcome what he calls the globalization of indifference. His most famous articulation of this phrase happened when he went to Lampedusa, that small little island off the coast of Africa, where 20,000 people have perished over the last 25 years trying to flee persecution and poverty in northern Africa. Many of them are Christians. who are fleeing very difficult situations. And when we see more and more people being beheaded in beaches, we need to know that they need to have some place to go. And 2 weeks before he visited, a whole boat had capsized against the southernmost part of Lampedusa, and the boat was crushing even women who were 8 months pregnant against the rocks. So he went there and he echoed two big questions. I think if the Pope is Pope till he's 100, this was his most powerful homily of all. He said, God's two questions echo today. Adam, where are you after sin? And to Cain, where is your brother? How many of us, myself included, he said, have lost our bearings. We don't know where we are because we're no longer attentive to the world in which we live. We don't care. We don't protect what God created. And we end up unable even to care for one another. And when humanity as a whole loses its bearings, it results in tragedy like the one we've witnessed here. Where is your brother? His blood cries out to me, says the Lord. He says, this is not a question directed to others. It's a question directed to me, to you, to each of us. These brothers and sisters were trying to escape difficult situations to find serenity and peace. They were looking for a better place for themselves and for their families, but instead they found death. How often do people fail to find understanding, acceptance, solidarity? And their cry rises up to God. He told a story. He was a literary teacher when he was exiled by the Jesuits after he had been a young provincial. He was a literature professor in high school, and he taught Lope de Vega. There's a story, a short story in there, about a place called Fuente Ovejuna. And there was a dictatorial governor there whom the people couldn't take any longer. So they all rose up, and together they murdered the governor. But they did it in such a way that nobody knew who had in fact been the cause of death. So when the investigators came on in and asked who killed the governor, their response was, Fuente Ovejuna, senor. Fuente Ovejuna, the sheep's well place, did it. And what he said as a result, everybody did it and nobody did it. Nobody was taking responsibility. And he said, many of us are like the folks in Fuente Ovejuna. We're fallen into the hypocrisy of the priest and the Levite whom Jesus described in the parable of the Good Samaritan. We see our brother half dead on the side of the road, and perhaps we say to ourselves, poor fella. But then we go on our way. It's not our responsibility, we tell ourselves. And with that we feel assuaged, reassured. The culture of comfort makes us insensitive to other people's cries. It leads to a globalization of indifference. In this globalized world, we've fallen into globalized indifference. We've become used to the sufferings of others. It doesn't affect me. It doesn't concern me. It's none of my business. Pope Francis says, obviously, Jesus didn't solve all the problems in Palestine. One of us isn't going to be able to solve all of these problems that face us. But he said we should at least be moved to weep over these situations. And he finished by asking, has any one of us wept because of this situation and others like it? Has any one of us grieved for the death of our brothers and sisters? For the people who are on the boat? We're a society that has forgotten how to weep, how to experience compassion, how to suffer with others. That this globalization of indifference has taken from us the ability to weep. And he asked the Lord to restore to us this compassion. What's the opposite of that globalization of indifference? He says, it's living the kingdom of God as good Samaritans who take responsibility for their brothers and sisters. In a vigil for Syria, September of 2013, he said, God's world is a world where everyone feels responsible for the other, for the good of the other. But we have to ask, is this the world I really desire? Is this the world I carry in my heart? Is this the world in which I'm living, which I take responsibility for another? We too are asked the same question Cain was. It's good for us to ask ourselves the question, am I really my brother's keeper? And he responded, yes, you are. To be human means to care for one another. But when harmony is broken, a metamorphosis occurs. The brother who is to be cared for and loved becomes an adversary to eliminate. Many of you have probably been to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. And when you're coming down that escalator, that staircase at the end, you see those words of Haim Gnaught there about the learned engineers who built the concentration camps and always suspicious of education. And he begged every teacher to teach in such a way that the students would not become educated Eichmann, but people who were really human, who cared for each other. Pope Francis is saying that the church needs to be that school, forming us to cross the road, forming our heart to be moved, and transforming the church into the inn where Christ, through others, are able to take those who are wounded to be nursed until Christ comes a second time. Behind this globalization of indifference, Pope Francis says, is a spiritual worldliness which is different than the spirituality of the kingdom. What is spiritual worldliness? When we begin to place our faith, hope, and love in the things of this world, where we begin to serve mammon and what mammon can obtain rather than serve the Lord. You mentioned on a vigil of Pentecost, there's one problem that affects us Christians. The spirit of the world, the worldly spirit, which leads to self-sufficiency, to living by the spirit of the world rather than by the spirit of Jesus. When we put our trust in our own efforts rather than in God. And when this happens, the church becomes an institution or an enterprise, an NGO. She stops being a bride and ends up being an administrator. She becomes an inspector rather than a servant. Pope Francis spends a lot of time in Evangelii Gaudium talking about the spiritual worldliness. We don't have time to go through it, but I just want to talk about an application of it. He said, in this spiritual worldliness lurks behind a fascination with social and political gain, a pride in the ability to manage practical affairs, or an obsession with programs of self-help and self-realization. Spiritual worldliness feeds vainglory. And it often leads to tremendous corruption disguised as good, because rather than serving others, we begin to serve ourselves within that context. It can happen. That's the way corruption begins, where we start off really genuinely caring for others, but then it becomes about us. And it can affect our churches too. If you don't believe me, just think about what would happen in your church on Sunday if somebody was going to offer $10,000 to everybody who came. Your church would be packed. So would every Catholic church. And all we offer is God's holy word. Catholics believe we offered God's own body and blood, soul, and divinity. And 3/4 of Catholics, for example, think something else is more important. There really is a spiritual worldliness that seeks after the things of this world more than the things of God. One application of this spiritual worldliness is what he calls the ferocious idolatry of money. It's a very strong phrase. But he said it when he was doing a television interview in Brazil in July of 2013. He said, the world in which we're living has fallen into this ferocious idolatry of money. There's a worldwide policy dominated by the pursuit of money. What's in control is money. When this world of the ferocious idolatry of money reigns, everything focuses for the most part on the center. Those in the extreme of society, the young who don't work, the seniors who are too old to work, the handicapped who can't work, are excluded, they're badly taken care of, neglected, and discarded. It says this is the worship of the new golden calf. We have to be aware of it, that there's another God there. And a lot of the times it trumps. As a pastor, I see it all the time when people voluntarily choose when they don't have to work on the Lord's Day instead of worshiping the Lord on the Lord's Day. There is that idolatry. And that ferocious idolatry of money is connected to consumerism that helps to drive a throwaway culture, he said. At the very beginning of Evangelii Gaudium, he wrote, the great danger in today's world, pervaded as it is by consumerism, is the desolation and anguish born of a complacent yet covetous heart, the feverish pursuit of frivolous pleasures, and a blunted conscience. Whenever our interior life becomes caught up in its own interests and concerns, there's no longer space for others, no place for the poor. God's voice is no longer heard, the quiet joy of his love is no longer felt, and the desire to do good fades. This is a very real danger for believers too. Many fall prey to it and end up resentful, angry, and listless. The opposite of that consumerism is that receptivity in which we look to the Lord and ask Him to constantly give us Himself so that we can then give to others. All of this leads to what he describes as an economy of exclusion rather than one of encounter, in which if people are no longer useful to us, we push them to the sides. And that's what has to be overcome. He's used one analogy over and over again, which he took from a rabbi, of the building of the Tower of Babel. The rabbi had explained that as they were building the tower, one of the bricks had fallen to the ground. And because it was so difficult to make bricks in the ancient world, everybody lamented. But when one of the bricklayers fell from the top of the tower and died, nobody really cared. Pope Francis said in Evangelii Gaudium that if the stock market loses a couple points, it's front page. But if a poor person dies of exposure in the streets, very few people ever notice. And I think that it's important for us to recognize that that statement is true. We don't give enough attention there. We don't give enough attention there. Because there is, in a sense, this focus on those who are in the center rather than those on the periphery. And he's trying to make us all one big family anew. Concluding thought is that Pope Francis is one of the most provocative popes we've ever had. He was a retreat master for many years who sought to help people come to conversion, to repent and believe again and again and again. And this comes out throughout his papacy. He doesn't show the same attention that, for example, Pope Benedict or John Paul II might to balancing one side against the other when he speaks, lest any partial thoughts be taken for the whole. He speaks forthrightly to those on one side seeking to provoke them to conversion. And then a few days later, he'll speak to the other side trying to do the same thing. But in the meantime, there'll be a confusion over those 3 days. You saw that, for example, with his comment about rabbits, right? And then 3 days later, he prays big families. I mean, this is the type of thing that he does in his communication style. Many Catholics just aren't used to this style of leadership or teaching. Likewise, as the Jesuits are wont to do in their spiritual direction, he often can be very critical to break us down so that after he can build us up again. In the first 2 years of his papacy, as we see, especially in his daily Mass homily, he analyzes more than synthesizes. He criticizes more than he praises. But all of this is in view, I think, of the ecclesial conversion he seeks to bring about. With regard to the economic realities within the social teaching of the gospel, Pope Francis said in Evangelii Gaudium, "If anyone feels offended by my words, I'd respond that I speak them with affection and with the best of intentions, quite apart from any personal interest or political ideology. My words aren't those of a foe or opponent. I'm interested only in helping those who are enthralled to an individualistic, indifferent, and self-centered mentality to be freed from those unworthy chains and to attain a way of life and thinking that's more humane, noble, and fruitful, which will bring dignity to their presence on earth." He's hoping that we will lead the charge to change with him, cooperation in response to God's grace. He says, "Any church community, if it thinks it can comfortably go its own way without creative concern and effective cooperation in helping the poor to live with dignity and reaching out to everyone, will also risk breaking down, however much it may talk about social issues or criticize and interact with government. It will easily drift into a spiritual worldliness camouflaged by religious practices, unproductive meetings, and empty talk." His reform involves a poor church for the poor, so that we may all give better witness to the treasure of heaven, to the pearl of great price, to Jesus, who himself chose to become poor to enrich us, and then joyfully turns to all of us and says, "Come follow me," and then go to the whole world, even to the extremes and peripheries, proclaiming the gospel, teaching them to carry out everything I've commanded you. He never calls us to anything, this Lord, unless he's prepared to give us all the help he knows we need to do it. Through Pope Francis, he's trying to give us some of that assistance so that his kingdom, for which we constantly pray, may come. Thanks very much for your attention. We've got time for conversation and questions.